contents, housing. And I sat there in a kind of stunned silence. It was such a breathtaking thing that you could dream that someday Negroes might have the chance to live wherever they wanted to. It was like getting drunk, that there was a world leader like Rabbi Wise who could even dream of thinking that we would have a ghetto-less country. But Horty Gable was a reformer with a difference. She listened to the people she was supposed to be helping. Later, a city housing official, she would be described as the only one who really has a close relationship with the Negro community. And during 1951 and 1952, when Robert Moses and the press were cheering Moses' gigantic new Title I slum clearance or urban renewal program, the director of the Committee Against Discrimination in Housing, leaving her office, a tiny 10-foot by 14-foot cubbyhole on the top floor of an ancient loft building, attended meetings of Negro and Puerto Rican organizations in the evenings, and her ears picked up the first whispered rumors about what was going on the Title I sites, rumors so terrible that she went up to visit the sites for herself, on a trip that would lead her to say, years later, "I visited a lot of bad slums, but I never saw any worse than the Title I slums when the developers started milking them. I remember I went into a building on the Godfrey Nurse site, and, as any woman instinctively does, when I went into a bathroom, I glanced into a mirror to see if my hair was straight. And when I looked at the mirror, or where the mirror ought to be, I found myself looking straight into the next apartment." For Lawrence Orton, it was statistics. During his decades on the City Planning Commission, Orton had learned to cast a wary eye on Moses. And he had a sense that there was something wrong, very wrong, with the statistics that the coordinator was issuing, and that the press was reprinting without the slightest attempt at verification to demonstrate that every consideration was being shown to families being relocated from Title I sites. But he was not only obeying, but going beyond the federal requirement that these families be relocated in decent, safe, and sanitary dwellings. In order to set at rest any fears, Moses had announced in his brochure on the Manhattan Town project that would require the raising of 6 square blocks of tenements and old apartment houses on the Upper West Side, "Families are assured that relocation help will be readily available, and there is a frank desire to be of maximum assistance in carrying out the individual wishes of each family. If they wanted to move into the new, modern apartments being erected on the site, they would be given preferential status in applying," he promised. "If they preferred to find their own new apartments, they would be assisted by personal counseling from a trained relocation firm, which," he said, "was compiling a citywide listing of vacancies, and by financial assistance from the developers, at the minimum, moving expenses plus the first month's rent in new quarters. And families still unable to find new apartments did not have to worry. They, all relocated Title I site families, in fact, could always move into low-income public housing projects, which would represent an improvement in their living quarters anyway. Their applications would be given first priority." Each of Moses' statements was backed up by columns of statistics in the stylish brochures issued in a steady stream by the mayor's slum clearance committee, which the coordinator headed. For example, the statistics on family income, family size, and a half dozen other indices proved, he said, that more than a quarter of the families presently living on the site, 998 out of 3,628, would be able to afford to live in the proposed Manhattan Town development at anticipated rentals. Orton's years of dealing with housing problems told him that the statistics were false. No tenement tenants he had ever met could afford Moses' anticipated Title I rentals. Orton could not prove that statistic false without a detailed analysis of the financial situation of the Manhattan Town site tenants. But what bothered him even more were the statistics on public housing. Orton knew all too well that existing public housing was already fully occupied. Familiar with city building plans, he had been under the general impression that there was little new low-income housing scheduled for imminent construction, and checking, he found that his impression was all too correct. the total number of public housing units scheduled for construction during the next year or two was a mere fraction of the number of tenants Moses was telling the world that he was going to move into those units. Analyzing Moses' soothing statistics, Orton was able to see, all too well, how the coordinator had arrived at them. With every project, Title I or some expressway or whatever, he would say, "Don't worry about the people living there. If they don't want to go anywhere else, we've always got room for them in public housing." But what he was doing was using the same public housing vacancies for many projects. The same vacancies that were alleged to be available for one project had already been allocated for a previous project, or perhaps 10 previous projects. Orton began to wonder exactly what Moses was planning. Tens of thousands of persons were now living on urban renewal sites. Where was the coordinator planning to put them? For Walter Fried, it was garbage cans. Strolling the brownstone-lined side streets of his neighborhood, the neat, solid, stolid, middle-class west side around 94th Street and West End Avenue where he lived, during the winter of 1952 and the spring of 1953, the Regional Council of the Federal Housing and Home Finance Agency had had a sense that it was changing somehow. "Some of the buildings began to seem a little seedy, a little run down," he recalls. But it was a vague sense. There wasn't anything really dramatic that you could put your finger on. You had a feeling that the whole neighborhood was beginning to show signs of disrepair, but there was nothing specific. And then one day, Fried suddenly realized that, without taking note of it, he had for some time been seeing something quite specific indeed. In front of some of the brownstones, there were more garbage cans than there should have been. And Fried's housing expertise told him the significance of that fact. "You'd walk past a four-story brownstone," Fried says. "Those brownstones had always been inhabited by, at most, four families. But in front of that brownstone now, there might be four large garbage cans. The garbage for four families is not anywhere near four large cans, not when the garbage was being picked up every day, as it was at that time. So you knew that there were many more people living there now than there had been before. And you knew what that meant. The landlords were breaking up the apartments inside into smaller apartments, so the same space that had been occupied by a family of five might now be occupied by 12 people. When you saw that many garbage cans, you knew that this building was being run now as a tenement for very poor families, or even as a rooming house." When the heat of the New York summer arrived, expertise was no longer required to tell what was happening. The evidence of change was out in the open, leaning on the windowsills of the brownstones turned tenements, sitting on their stoops, crowding the benches on the islands in the middle of Broadway, people, poor people, Negro and Puerto Rican people, people in such numbers that the Broadway benches, long crowded anyway with Jewish grandmothers and grandfathers, were now crowded as never before. It wasn't just the fact that these people didn't have white skin that disturbed the older residents of the West Side. It was that they obviously didn't have money either. It was that so many were obviously drunk or on drugs. And it was that there were so many of them. With the first hot day of 1953, the West Side was, all at once, not just a racially mixed neighborhood, but a much poorer neighborhood, and a much more crowded one. And month by month, its deterioration accelerated. 94th and 95th Streets between West End and Riverside Drive, nice, quiet blocks before, became a shambles, Fried recalls. It had been happening for months, probably, but in the heat it was intolerable to stay inside those places, so now it began to spill out into the streets. You began to notice the hopheads, the alcoholics. Every night the city ambulance was out. The cops would come screaming down the streets. Trying to think back and determine what major change on the West Side had caused so drastic a crumbling of a neighborhood that for decades had stood so solid, Fried could think of only one. The $54 million Manhattan Town Urban Renewal Project between Central Park West and Amsterdam Avenue and between 97th and 100th Streets. And recalling dates, he realized that the deterioration of his neighborhood, some blocks away from Manhattan Town though it was, had begun not long after Moses had turned over the 6-square-block site to the developers. Freed began to direct his walks toward the site, and with every block that he drew nearer, conditions worsened. Blight was obviously spreading out from Manhattan Town. In little more than a year, the streets immediately adjacent to the development, always poor and predominantly Negro, but previously with well-maintained buildings, had become a slum, a teeming, seething hive of humanity, a place of squalid, run-down, dilapidated tenements so overcrowded that children had to sleep in shifts, of doorways filled with drunks and narcotics addicts and gutters filled with garbage. Obviously, Freed saw, the area had been inundated with a flood of new residents, and there was no place these residents could have come from so suddenly and in such numbers but Manhattan Town. A project designed, at immense cost, to clear up a localized 6-block-square slum infection was instead causing that infection to spread over many more than 6 other blocks. Trying to figure out why, Freed began to have suspicions disturbing to this longtime admirer of Robert Moses. Federal law required families on urban renewal sites to be relocated in a considerate, humane manner. Every block of the area through which Freed was walking brimmed over with indications that the families on the Manhattan Town site were simply fleeing from their homes into the nearest available shelter, no matter how inadequate. What was Moses doing on that site anyway? Freed's job required frequent tours of the city. Now, his eyes sharpened by the West Side experience, he began to realize that he had been seeing, in different settings, similar symptoms. Traveling through the Rockaway Peninsula one cold winter day, he had happened to pass the sprawling colonies of summer bungalows in Arverne. He had passed those bungalows before in winter, and they had always been vacant, for the flimsy little structures, each barely big enough to accommodate a single family, provided little protection from the cold and damp. This time, to his shock, he had found all the bungalows filled. There were several shivering Negro and Puerto Rican families in each. He had heard disturbing rumors about tenants from other Title I sites being dumped by the hundreds into vacant tenements in a section of Brooklyn called Brownsville. What was Moses doing on all his Title I sites? By 1953, many New York liberals concerned with housing were asking that question. And some, such as Hortense Gable and Stanley Isaacs, began going to the sites to see the answer for themselves. They returned horrified. Stanley came back sick, just sick, an associate recalls. He said, "They're hounding those people out like cattle." These liberals began to understand that something terrible was going on some of the Title I sites. Not the sites turned over by Moses to organizations such as the Rockefeller-backed Morningside Corporation or the ILGWU, but the sites he had turned over to corporations hastily set up by Democratic clubhouse politicians, allegedly fronting for bigger politicians, something whose shape they were only beginning to dimly glimpse through the curtain of Moses' assurances, but something whose shape was huge and frightening in its implications not only for New York's poor, but for the city as a whole. If Moses simply hounded the people living on those sites out of their homes without finding them new homes, these liberals realized, they would have no choice but to flee to other slums, to further crowd tenements already horribly overcrowded, to live in their cellars, their basements, in apartments without kitchens or bathrooms, in tiny rooms carved out of rooms that had been tiny before they had been made tinier to receive them. That would make conditions in the city's existing slums, conditions already bestial, inhuman, even worse. And the residents of Title I sites numbered not in the thousands, but in the tens of thousands. Crowd as they would into slums, there would not be enough room in the slums for them. So they would move into areas adjacent to the slums, into areas in which landlords, without incentive to keep up their property anyway because of the slums' proximity, would see an opportunity for financial profit and take it by breaking up large apartments into small and by cutting down on maintenance and repairs. The slums would spill over their boundaries, spreading into blocks as yet untouched by blight. Moreover, some slum dwellers hounded from their homes would flee into soft areas of the city such as Brownsville, neighborhoods in which there were a large number of vacancies. These vacancies would now be filled in a rush by the dispossessed of the ghetto. The policy Moses might be pursuing would create new slums. The city must be alerted to what was happening, these liberals felt. The public must be educated to the facts about what was really happening. The people must be aroused. But the public was not educated or aroused, because the only medium through which it could be educated or aroused, its press, was not interested. The liberals wanted the press to get the facts behind Title I, but the press made no move to get them. It was the Times that counted, and Isaacs and other reformers with entree to its editors repeated the attempts made by reformers like McCanany and Windels in other generations. They attempted to persuade the Times to send out reporters to ascertain if the statements Moses was making, and that the Times was printing as if they were fact, were actually factual. And the results were the same that McCanany and Windels had achieved. A single entry in a log on Title I developments kept by a reformer with entree, Eleanor G. Black, tells the story. Called New York Times. Illison, reporter Mary Illison, called back Saturday. Said it would be better if we made a statement. Times not a crusading paper. The Tribune or the Daily News would have helped. But when reformers talked to Tribune editors, they found that the paper's refusal to attack Moses, while, as Orton says, not anything like the open secret it was at the Times, was just as firm. As for the News, it was to fulfill its responsibility to the public by exposing communists in the housing authority. Says Orton, if you came in with any information that might be derogatory to Moses, the News wouldn't give you the time of day. Among the city's other dailies, only Dorothy Schiff's Post told readers there might be another side to the Title I story besides Moses. All right, these liberals said. If the press refused to go out and get the facts for itself, they would get the facts for it. They were able to do so in large part because Orton had gone underground with the City Planning Commission's Master Plan Unit when Moses had eased Bennett in as the commission's chairman 2 years before. The unit's offices on the 15th floor of a Park Row office building were only just across City Hall Park from commission headquarters in the municipal building. But the distance was, apparently, sufficient for security. Bennett never once set foot in the place, Orton says, smiling. More important, the chairman hardly ever inquired as to what the unit was doing, and never pressed Orton to explain on his uncharacteristically evasive answers. As a result, Orton says, my boys just vanished as far as the rest of the city government was concerned. This was a subversive activity. A real, authentic 15th-story job. No one gave us anything to do, so we could do whatever we wanted. And now they began doing what no one else had ever done during the 20 years during which Robert Moses had been building public works in New York City, finding out how many people were being evicted from their homes to make way for them, what was happening to those people, and what was happening to the city as a result. The difficulties were immense. Moses' relocation statistics had always been accepted. No city agency or newspaper had ever computed them even roughly for itself. There were probably all-over statistics in existence, of course, and brought together in one place. But the place was Randall's Island, and Randall's ruler kept the long rows of filing cabinets there locked. Many of the statistics were kept in the City Bureau of Real Estate, but the Bureau was under Moses' thumb. It was after attempts to obtain its statistics, supposedly public records, that Orton, ordinarily so punctilious in speech, said with real passion one evening, "The real estate bureau was a stench in my nostrils." What statistics were available, often in obscure files in other city agencies, of whose existence the unit would never have known were it not for Orton's encyclopedic knowledge of every corner of city government, were patently too low. Moses kept them low by refusing to count the actual number of people being evicted. Instead, he multiplied each dwelling unit by an average family size so small as to bear no discernible relation to reality, and by simply ignoring the existence of doubled-up families and boarders, of whom there are always a significant number in low-income areas, as well as of people living in rooming houses or hotels. There is considerable evidence to suggest that the counts thus arrived at, even after these omissions, were arbitrarily reduced still further when Moses felt they sounded too high. Orton's unit could not repair these deficiencies. With the buildings in which these uncounted tenants had lived demolished and the tenants moved away, there was no longer any way of obtaining a record of their existence. Yet the unit did come up with a rough compilation. During the 7 years since the end of World War II, there had been evicted from their homes in New York City for public works, mainly Robert Moses' public works, some 170,000 persons. This total was almost certainly far too low. Orton, leaning over backwards as always to be fair and to make sure that the figures would stand up no matter what devices Moses employed to discredit them, leaned too far. He permitted his unit to make some adjustment in official figures, but not nearly enough to make them accurate. And he permitted his boys to include as public works only projects public in toto. He did not permit them to include projects such as Stuyvesant Town, Peter Cooper Village, Riverton, and Concord Village, although he should have, for though the money that built them was supposedly private money, the tax abatement that Moses arranged for them would, when totaled over the years, ensure that the public investment in them would dwarf the private, and the powers that Moses utilized to make possible not only their construction but the assemblage of their sites, eminent domain, street closings, utility easements, were all public. The number of persons relocated for Stuyvesant Town alone was, by Moses' own figures, 12,000. But the 170,000 figure was eye-opening enough. Robert Moses had, in just slightly more than 7 years, moved from their homes more people than lived in Albany, Phoenix, Little Rock, Sacramento, Tallahassee, Topeka, Baton Rouge, Trenton, Santa Fe, etc. In terms even of huge New York, the unit was to report, this was an enforced population displacement completely unlike any previous population movement in the city's history. If the number of persons evicted for public works was eye-opening, so were certain of their characteristics. Their color, for example. A remarkably high percentage of them were Negro or Puerto Rican. Remarkably few of them were white, although the 1950 census had found that only 12% of the city's population was non-white. At least 37% of the evictees, Moses' own figures, and probably far more, were non-white. And their income. The income of evictees, not only for slum clearance projects, but for all Moses' public works, including expressways, was far below the citywide average. In 1951, the Federal Bureau of Labor Statistics found that $4,083 was needed for a family of four to maintain a minimum standard of living for a year. Only one out of every four of the evicted families earned $4,083 per year. 20% earned less than $2,000 per year. Liberals had long suspected that most of the people evicted by Moses were poor people, and particularly poor Negroes and Puerto Ricans, hampered in apartment hunting not only by poverty but by discrimination. The Orton survey confirmed these suspicions. Moses was throwing out of their homes precisely those people who were least able to find new homes. And the manner in which he was throwing them out was worth noting, too. Because it was so difficult for these people to find decent homes on their own, the government of their city, the government which had authorized their eviction from their old homes, had solemnly promised them help. Its highest legislative body had pledged that tenants will not be evicted from the site of a public improvement unless and until quarters equivalent to those occupied are available. Moses, ostensibly the instrument of that government, had for 7 years created the impression that he was honoring that pledge. He had stated that a minimum of inconvenience was involved in relocation. Orton staffers found that a substantial number of families had been moved two or more times to other buildings within the site, had been shuttled from one building about to be demolished to another, and then to another, and perhaps yet another. For 7 years, Moses had been giving the impression that the bulk of the low-income families displaced by his public works had been accommodated in public housing projects. In reality, the unit found, the percentage of displaced families that had been admitted to public housing was pathetically small. Moses had been giving the impression that he had taken great pains to ensure every evictee decent, safe, and sanitary living quarters. When the Planning Commission staffers obtained access to files on tenants for whom relocation responsibility had been discharged, they found that more than a third of the files, for some projects more than half, were marked disappeared, whereabouts unknown. Disappeared. Moses couldn't know that the living quarters into which his projects had forced tens of thousands of persons were decent, safe, and sanitary. He couldn't know what the new living quarters were like. He didn't even know where those living quarters were. Orton's handful of staffers, without sufficient time to trace the individual families involved in relocation, were unable to locate those missing families. But it was all too obvious that they had been moved either to other sections of the ghettos, doubling up with other families, causing further overcrowding in those already intolerably overcrowded slums, or to adjoining areas, creating slums out of once decent neighborhoods. Robert Moses' slum clearance program might be creating new slums as fast as it was clearing the old. If this picture of the past was disturbing, it paled before the picture of the future. Orton staffers had assembled, for the first time, statistics on the volume of tenant displacement we may expect in the foreseeable future. During the previous 7 years, 170,000 persons had been evicted, a rate of about 24,000 per year. But Moses' slum clearance program was only now moving into high gear. During the next 3 years, 150,000 persons were scheduled for eviction, 50,000 per year. These people were mostly low-income Negroes and Puerto Ricans. If future relocation was carried out as past relocation had been carried out, it would increase overcrowding in existing slums and create new ones faster than before. The city's relocation practices should be changed, taken out of the hands of the Moses-dominated Slum Clearance Committee and Housing and Triborough authorities, in the name of common humanity, Orton's report said. And these practices should be changed in the name of the city's own interest. If they were not, the vast urban renewal programs, the unprecedented expenditure of public funds, which the city was undertaking to improve its future, would wreck that future instead. Orton's statistics proved that without a doubt. The Women's City Club went beyond statistics. Even Moses could hardly call these civics in skirts radicals. Charter members could recall that during the national debate on women's suffrage, opinion within the club had by no means been unanimous. In 1953, the club's liberalism was still the narrow-gauged, less militant liberalism of the 1930s. But its membership roles included women who had been campaigning for better housing for decades, and they were worried because, under Moses' procedure, relocation was being handled not by the city, but by a private real estate firm. The club decided to do what no newspaper, government agency, or other civic group had done before. Study relocation on a Title I site, they selected Manhattan Town, in detail, on the site. No whispers prepared the club's young women for what they found. As one observer was later to describe it, Manhattan Town looked like a cross-section of bombed-out Berlin right after World War II. Some of the tenements were still standing, broken windows gaping sightlessly at the sky, basement doors yawning uncovered on the sidewalks, and surrounding them were acres strewn with brick and mortar and rubble where wreckers and bulldozers had been at work. And in the buildings, the ruins of buildings, the shells of buildings, people still lived. Visiting those people, entering those shells of buildings, shrinking perhaps past the huddled wreckage of a man that lay in the doorway, stepping into a dim hallway filled with the stench of urine and vomit, and, in its shadows, a vague menace, stumbling up unlit flights of stairs that had steps missing, grasping for a banister that wasn't there, was an unnerving experience for these women. Mrs. Eleanor Black recalls a man on the street shouting earnestly as she opened the door to one tenement, "Don't go in there, lady. It's not safe to go in there." But it was an educational experience. For the people living in the ruins of Manhattan Town taught the good ladies of the Women's City Club something about slums that they hadn't learned in their textbooks. In the textbooks, slums were synonymous with dirt and blight. But, recalls Mrs. Black, "the thing that hit me was that most of the apartments you went into were well kept, clean." Time after time, City Club volunteers would walk off the filthy street, up the filthy stairs, down a filthy hall, and knock on the door of an apartment. And when the door to that apartment was opened, behind the frightened face peering out, "Oh, they were always frightened," one of the volunteers said. "They always thought you were from the developer or the city. Was a room neat and clean?" "What hurt the most," Mrs. Black says, "was just the feeling of people trying to make a decent place for their family to live in these conditions." It is possible to read through scores of textbooks and tracts on housing conditions written in the 1940s and early 1950s without finding even a hint of the fact that many of these women volunteers who had read the textbooks now learned for the first time. To the people who lived in them, slums were home. The people who lived in those buildings Robert Moses was tearing down were not just passing through. The Puerto Ricans, a small fraction of the area's population, were relative newcomers, of course, although by 1953, 13% of its Puerto Ricans had lived there for more than 10 years. But among the Negro and white families, more than half had lived in their apartments for several decades. Women's City Club members who had been taught that slum connoted transience sat and listened as one family after another informed them that they had lived in their building since it was built, 30 or 40, or in one case, 54 years before. The people of the area knew each other. Shopkeepers said hello to their customers when they happened to pass them on the street. The Manhattan Town area was a slum area. Its people were poor. The average weekly income was $60 per family. Its buildings were old. There hadn't been a new building constructed in it in 25 years. Most of them were overcrowded with families of 5 or 6 members jammed into apartments that should have held no more than 3 or 4, and many were dilapidated. But the area was also stable, settled, friendly. Its people had a sense of community, of neighborhood, that some of the members of the Women's City Club realized, driving home at night to their luxurious homes in the sterile suburbs, they wished they had. The textbooks didn't speak of advantages in talking about slums, but, the more perceptive of these women realized, the Manhattan Town slum had advantages. There were no playgrounds in it, of course, but there was Central Park. Most families, the club's report would conclude, seemed to be well satisfied with the neighborhood facilities, with the good bus and subway transportation, the good shopping facilities, and nearness to the heart of the city. It was a racially integrated area, a fact very important to the Negro families, not only because they wanted their children to grow up with white children, but because they knew, as the City Club was to report, that services such as garbage and snow removal, schools and shopping, were far better in non-segregated areas. and the area didn't have some of the disadvantages associated with slums. Drugs, for example, were already a scourge in slums like Harlem. The junkie was a rarity here. The buildings in which they lived might be dilapidated and overcrowded, but they were palaces compared to buildings in Harlem. Most important to the families who lived here and were trying to bring up their children decently, rents were low, low enough so that they could do so. 3/4 of the 400 families interviewed were paying less than $50 per month. The average rent per room was $10 per month. In other areas of the city, including most slum areas, rents were much higher, so high that low-income families had to skimp on clothes and food for their children in order to pay them. The more perceptive of the women learned that, while the people who lived in the Manhattan Town area did not have much in life, what they did have, their neighborhood gave them. And they learned about the helplessness of the poor in the city, a helplessness so much greater than even the helplessness of the lower middle class people of East Tremont. The old people alone, dreaded the room, the single furnished box, four walls and no more, in which they might have to live out their days if they lost the tiny apartments with their own toilet and cooking facilities for which they now managed to scrape up the rent each month. "I would die if they put me in a room," one old man told the nice young woman in the well-tailored dress who had come to ask him questions. Parents of young children dreaded Harlem, the name by which they referred not only to Manhattan's great black slum, but to black slums not yet identified by names such as Brownsville or Bed-Stuy. The Harlem in which their children would have to sleep with them in the same room. The Harlem in which they would have to live with cockroaches and rats. The Harlem in whose schools their kids wouldn't learn, and in which the drug pushers would be waiting for them. The Harlem in whose streets the garbage lay piling day after day. The Harlem whose landlords would squeeze them dry. One question on the Women's City Club questionnaire was where the family being interviewed would like to live. Mother after mother, seeing the abyss before her eyes and her children, answered with a reply that was a cry for help out of the depths of fear. Anywhere, but not Harlem. But, the club's volunteers knew, unless someone helped these people, unless someone kept the city's promise to find them decent, safe, and sanitary dwellings within their financial means, the room and Harlem were where they were going to have to go. For, the volunteers came to realize, these people had no choice. Color barred the Negroes and Puerto Ricans among them from most non-slum neighborhoods. Poverty barred the whites among them from most non-slum neighborhoods. Stated the Women's City Club report, one tenant reported visiting real estate offices almost daily for the past year, but whatever listings appeared were always prohibitive in price. The size of many of the area's families, 25% contained five or more persons, cemented the bars in place. Said one tenant, "We have 6 children. I looked and looked everywhere, but apartments don't want so many children." Many landlords, able to pick and choose among tenants because of the housing crisis, didn't want any children. Asked one mother bitterly, "Am I supposed to drown them?" Most of the families interviewed, not all, a number which the interviewers found surprisingly large, expressed real affection for their neighborhood, did not fool themselves into thinking that their neighborhood was ideal. They were living there because they had no place else to go. Their only alternative was the abyss. And it was because the volunteers realized this that they were filled with indignation when they found out how Moses was helping these people. Moses had stated that evicted families who wanted to move into the new apartments to be built on the site would be given preferential status in applying. In reality, Mrs. Black learned, they were being discouraged from applying at all. No applications were being accepted for Manhattan Town, and none would be until most of the families now on the site were gone. Not that Moses' precaution was really necessary. The evicted families had been paying an average of $10 rent per room per month. The rent in Manhattan Town was going to be, if Moses' figures could be believed, $34 per room per month, about $100 for even a small three-room apartment. Out of 400 families interviewed, exactly one said it could afford to pay $100 per month rent. The families being displaced cannot even consider the possibility of applying for the new project displacing them. Where will they go? Not in any numbers into public housing. Moses had stated that Title I displaced families would be given first priority in applying for such housing. Priorities meant little, however, because the public housing Moses was building had, with its lack of apartments for large families or single people, build. There was never any thought as to what he was building, little relationship to the needs of the displaced people. As to whether any priority was in fact given to these people, almost 300 of the 400 families interviewed wanted to get into public housing. A check by the Women's City Club 3 years later would show that only 50 had made it. Promising personal counseling, the compilation of a citywide list of available, decent, safe, and sanitary dwellings within the financial means of the families to be displaced, and financial assistance, at least moving expenses plus a month's rent, to enable them to move into them, Moses had stated that, in order to set at rest any fears, families are assured that relocation help will be readily available, and there is a frank desire to be of maximum assistance in carrying out the individual wishes of each family. The notice to move that the families actually got was a little more curt. Not even mailed to the individual families, but tacked up in the entrances to their homes, it said, "Demolition of this building will be started at once. Tenants must vacate. For information, call Relocation Office, corner of West 100th Street." When they called or went in person, there were no personal interviews, no counseling. There was no information on finding apartments. The citywide listing of vacancies? No listing of any vacancies was available. There was no help in finding apartments. "I looked everywhere and couldn't find anything," one man told an interviewer. "Now I don't know where else to look, and when I ask them for help, they just say they can't help me." Maximum assistance? In that relocation office, there was not even minimum mercy. "I'm 74 and too sick to look, and no one helps you," one woman said. The Women's City Club interviewer's report on the T family reads, "Mr. T was injured in accident and is now unable to walk stairs. He must attend the rehabilitation clinic daily. Mrs. T is disabled and has difficulty getting around. The son is recovering from polio, and the boarder who lives with them is blind. They cannot look for other quarters. No one is helping them." Financial assistance? The assistance for which the developers were being given $1 million by the city? Except in rare instances, these impoverished people could not even obtain reimbursements for the moving expenses which they were being forced to incur through no choice of their own. Not only were they forced to move out of their homes, they were forced to pay for the moving. What was available, for most of the people who had lived on the site, was a single piece of advice: get out, and get out fast. Returning stunned from the corner of West 100th Street, one man said he had been told to be out in 10 days. The inducement offered them to move, not in 10 days, of course, that was just a scare tactic to soften them up and make sure they wouldn't be too insistent on their rights, was somewhat more subtle than those mentioned in Moses' glowing brochures. The developers owned the tenements now, and they simply stopped maintaining them. Said the report, "Typical of the statements made by tenants were the following comments. No repairs are ever made. There are large holes in the walls and floors where rats come through. The toilet bowl has been broken for a long time, but they won't fix it. The plaster is coming down over the stove. If I bake a pie, the plaster comes right down into it." One interview carried the terse report, "Baby screamed. Rat in crib." Reading the filled-in questionnaires piled in her office, Eleanor Black wrote, The bewilderment of people being forced out of their homes and their inability to cope with problems beyond their control was most evident. Also evident, recorded in the handwriting on those questionnaires, was apathy. I have no money to move, so why should I waste time looking? I'll just wait. God and faith will find something for me. Despair. I walked from 109th Street to 23rd Street and couldn't find a thing for us. The rents are too high. There's nothing to do. And most of all, hatred and bitterness. Hatred and bitterness at the vague, unseen force that was doing this to them, a force they identified only as the city. The city doesn't care about us. We're just nothing as far as they're concerned. Bitterness and hatred that would have been understood so well by Alfred E. Smith, who once, standing in the well of the Assembly Chamber in Albany, had asked, "What must be the feelings of the widowed mother when she sees these children separated from her by due process of law? What can be the feelings in the hearts of the children themselves to know what the state's policy was with respect to their unfortunate condition?" Now those feelings were understood by the Women's City Club. "God and faith will find something for me," an old Negro woman had said. God and faith would have to, realized the trim young matron who had interviewed her. The city wasn't going to. Robert Moses wasn't going to. And if any of the volunteer interviewers had any doubts as to whether the hatred and bitterness were justified, those doubts vanished when they moved on to the next step, finding out what had actually happened to the residents of buildings already demolished, people whose Title I caused future was no longer a matter of conjecture, but of reality. Finding out wasn't easy. The developer, Moses' reliable bidder, refused to talk to them, as did the relocation office, as did, for weeks, the director of the city's real estate bureau, the official charged on behalf of the city with the responsibility for seeing that the developer and the relocation firm gave the evicted tenants the decent, safe, and sanitary dwellings that the city had promised them. And when he finally consented to see them, and they asked him where the tenants had moved to, he said he didn't know. He had never checked, he said. They checked. 50 of the 400 families, of course, had been placed in public housing, although they found that many of these lucky evictees, desperately lonely for their friends from the old neighborhood, felt, as did one aged woman, who said, "If they put the old house back, I'd move in again, even though I had to make my own hot water and heat." The others were more difficult to trace. Some had left no forwarding address deliberately, to avoid creditors or payment of rent, or because of fear of the law or governmental agencies, as the Women's City Club report put it. Others, because, unable to speak English and inexperienced in even the basics of city life, they had left one not with the post office, but with a neighbor or with the building superintendent, who had later also moved. The club's volunteers tried to trace them. They walked the streets of the bombed-out Manhattan Town site, trying to find someone who knew the family for whom they were searching, combed school registration records throughout the city, hunting for the names of the family's children. But, after all feasible tracing methods had been exploited, the club said in a follow-up report, new addresses could be obtained for only 167 of the original 400 families. These were probably the people among the 400 who were best off, but even among them, the circumstances in which they were found were illuminating. The volunteers found some of them on the west side, in the area around Manhattan Town, in the brownstones turned tenements. Wrote one volunteer, "Some places were much worse than what the family had left. For example, a family of two moved from a four-room standard apartment with all utilities, central heating and hot water, private bath and toilet, into a three-room apartment in poor condition with no central heating, no refrigeration, tiny bath in kitchen, and hall toilet. Another family of three moved from four standard rooms to a six-room railroad flat with not a single enclosed room, holes in the floor and ceiling plaster falling. The volunteers found many of these families in the cellars of these tenements, in dark and dampness. "It's all right," one woman said when asked about her present quarters, "but I have arthritis now, which is not good, living in a basement." The volunteers found many of the old people in the furnished rooms of these tenements, the rooms that the old people had dreaded. Some of them had been living with their children and grandchildren when the volunteers had met them before, but they were living alone now because the new quarters their family could find were too small. For such apartments, moreover, the tenants were almost invariably forced to pay more rent than they had been paying before, often much more, often enough more to seriously affect the family's standard of living. These people were the lucky ones among the evictees that the club's volunteers could locate. They had managed to stay out of Harlem. Others had not. It was Harlem these families had dreaded, but it was in Harlem that the volunteers found them. Seeing these people, perhaps the best off among the evicted families, the volunteers could picture the others. They could picture the basements in which they must be huddled, the railroad flats into which they must be crammed, the loneliness in which they must be living, deprived of the friends of years. During their visits to these families, they had gotten to know some of their children, and the fears their mothers had harbored for their future if they had to bring them up in Harlem. They could picture the lives of the children now. And, the volunteers found, it was not the evictees who had moved to Harlem who were the worst off. It was those who had moved, who had, utterly unable to find apartments, been moved to new apartments on site, to the shells of buildings in the bombed-out Manhattan town site, to which the developer would not send a painter or plumber, much less an exterminator. One volunteer recalls glancing into a kitchen and recoiling in disgust from the sight of a ceiling literally alive with vermin. Moses, reliable developer, had moved some of these families not once, but several times, shoved them from one building that was about to be torn down into another whose demolition was still a while off, and then, when it came time for that building to be demolished, moved them again, hitting them with a rent increase each time. The Women's City Club volunteers saw very clearly the implications for the city of such relocation tactics. After months of research, they knew with absolute certainty that the Title I program as being administered by Robert Moses was creating new slums as fast or faster than it was clearing old ones. But, after the exposure to concentrated human misery which they had undergone, it was the implications not for the city, but for individual human beings that tore at their hearts. In writing the report, Eleanor Black leaned over backwards to keep it fair and understated, leaned over backwards so far that at times the stance of the report was almost ludicrously tilted. But, despite the understatement, at times the emotion these women felt seeped through. "The Moses-approved relocation policy," Mrs. Black wrote, "does not adequately meet the demands either of the law or of human decency." The City Planning Commission's Master Plan Unit had uncovered the statistics that disproved Moses' claims. The Women's City Club volunteers had gone beyond the statistics to document the falseness of the claims in terms of human misery. The misery was now documented, quantified, broken down into individual cases, and, with the issuance of the first Women's City Club report in March 1954, printed in black and white, as was the draft of the Master Plan Unit report. A complete picture of what was really happening in Title I was ready for presentation to the city at large. But the city did not see that picture. In part, it did not see that picture because of Moses. With the Master Plan Unit's relocation report completed, Orton's chief aide, Henry Cohen, and Hortense Gable, two liberals with a taste for political stratagem, began to plot ways to get the report before the public. They drafted a resolution requesting the Planning Commission to study the relocation problem created by public improvements, ordering us, in Orton's words, to do what we had already been doing. Introduced in March 1953 by Isaacs in the City Council and Wagner and Hawley in the Board of Estimate, it was adopted with little discussion. It was not the kind of measure to which a politician could easily object in an election year, and Moses did not get excited about studies that would take months, if not years, to complete. If indeed, thanks to his monopoly of available statistics, it could ever be completed at all. It may even have been his plan to see that the commission deferred taking any action on the request until it was forgotten. But when the study was mentioned at the next commission meeting, Orton blandly said, while Stuart Constable jolted out of the ostentatiously nonchalant slouch he habitually affected in imitation of R.M., bounced abruptly upright in his chair, that it was already completed and ready for adoption. Cohen and Mrs. Gable were convinced that a study bearing the official imprimatur of the City Planning Commission would receive prominent play in the press. Moses may have feared so, too. For 6 months, every attempt by Orton or his two allies on the commission, Blaustein and Livingston, to make the study official was defeated 4-3 by Moses and his three allies, engineer Robert G. McCullough of the Cross Bronx Expressway, Queens real estate operator Charles Sterla, and Chairman Bennett, who was, of course, secretly organizing one profitable Title I syndicate himself. A series of 4-3 votes even defeated every attempt to place the study on the commission's calendar for formal consideration. And while Moses was stalling the study, he was rewriting it. Some key statements were removed entirely. Others were modified subtly, just enough to change their meaning. In some cases, the study had read, the tenants were obliged to find their own new quarters. Now the study read, in some cases, the tenants voluntarily found new quarters. Others were modified less subtly. New, false statistics were inserted. One set showed that the living conditions of an overwhelming majority of relocated tenants had been improved by relocation. And in the introduction and recommendations chapters of the report, the chapters from which Moses knew the press generally selects its material, the whole tenor of the document was changed. Relocation procedures in the past, it now said, had been a noteworthy achievement for which credit is due, and the outlook for the next 4 years to be brighter than in the past. Those who had been in charge of the past should be left in charge in the future. The major recommendation of the report was a smokescreen added by Moses to draw attention away from the tenant relocation that was its ostensible subject, a proposal to finance public housing by a $2 per year tax on every telephone in the city. When, after 16 major civic organizations joined in demanding the report's release, and after the Post had been telling its readers for weeks about the report Moses suppresses, and the Times and Herald Tribune had finally begun to report the conflict on the commission, and after Impilateri's defeat by Wagner had made it obvious that the report could not be bottled up indefinitely, the commission in December 1953, more than 9 months after it had been written, adopted a tenant relocation report. It was not the report as originally presented, but the report as rewritten by Moses, although so furious were Orton, Blaustein, and Livingston that Bennett found it politic to allow them to append a minority report, including most of the original points. The smokescreen on the Women's City Club report was thrown up by Samuel I. Rosenman, Moses' lawyer, who was also, for $250,000, Manhattan Towns, and who now proved that he was worth the money, putting at the service of his developer client not only his immense prestige that made his name a byword for integrity in New York, but also the talent for words that had made him a valued speechwriter for two presidents. Rosenman's statement defending Manhattan Town Inc. possessed rhythm, punch, everything but truth. The Women's City Club report, based upon an erroneous premise, does not reflect the situation as it existed at the time of the survey. It also does not reflect the situation as it exists today. Relocation has not progressed at as rapid a rate as we had hoped. Although it has been slow, it has been successful. we consider it successful because without imposing unnecessary hardships on tenants, a larger number of slum, substandard, and insanitary buildings have been cleared and have been demolished. Within the near future, new, safe, sanitary buildings will rise on the land thus cleared. And if it did not possess truth, it was so intricately woven a tissue of half-truths and misleading statistics that sorting out fact from fiction would be